Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And what's the secret to staying young? Some people say it's to keep trying new things as you get older. Enter the legendary cartoonist Jules Feiffer, who at age 85 has just released his first graphic novel. It's called Kill My Mother. Stylistically, it's noir and includes references to noir movie classics like The Maltese Falcon and Double Indemnity and at least one book by Raymond Chandler. You may know Jules Feiffer best from his years as the first New York Times op-ed cartoonist or the 40 years of wavy line strips in The Village Voice that came before. Maybe his plays or movies like Little Murders, Carnal Knowledge, Popeye, or I Want to Go Home, his classic children's book, The Phantom Tollbooth, or maybe the 1994 op-ed he wrote in The Times urging Mayor Giuliani not to destroy WNYC. In the end, he didn't, as you may realize. Jules Feiffer, it's an honor to have you come in. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, I'm glad I saved WNYC.
I never got to thank you for that until now. You remember that piece, right?
No, I don't, but I guess it worked.
You wrote an op-ed lauding the station. You mentioned me and Leonard Lope by name and other things. And since I brought it up, for people who don't know the history, the station used to be owned by the city. Giuliani decided city government shouldn't own a radio station anymore. He considered selling it off to the highest bidder, destroying it as public radio and turning it into another commercial station. WNYC plays the hits. But in the end, because your voice, Jules Feiffer, and many voices were raised, he allowed us to, in effect, buy ourselves, and we became the independent public radio station that we are today. So thanks for being one of those important voices raised exactly 20 years ago, 1994. I never got to thank you.
I wish I could point to other acts of effectiveness in my career, but they are very rare.
Maybe there were one or two. Did you grow up on noir movies and noir comic books?
Well, I was the right age. I was born in 29. And in the middle 30s, I was an addict of the adventure strips like Terry and the Pirates and The Spirit. And then shortly after, I discovered Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, and the movies started coming out. So all of that combined into this thing that formed my ambition in early years to be an adventure strip cartoonist and to do that kind of stuff.
How about those cartoons, the comic books? Were there certain comic book heroes that most captured your imagination as a young kid?
Nothing until Superman really came along. And, well, actually, the creators of Superman, Siegel and Shuster, did some adventure-style strips, something called Slam Bradley and another called Federal Man. I loved that stuff. It was all junk, but I loved it, and I loved the bravura drawing style and the primitiveness because my own style was pretty primitive, and I thought, well, I could be one of them.
You don't have a copy of Action Comics number one, do you?
No, I don't, but I still remember it very well.
Do you really? That's the first Superman, right?
That was the first Superman, yes.
The first image people will see when they open the book is of a bearded, trench coat-wearing, noir-looking guy standing in the rain, it looks like, and the dialogue bubble says, to Milton Caniff, Will Eisner, Hammett and Chandler and Kane, John Huston, Billy Wilder, Howard Hawks, and Joan Z. Holden. So I guess there's your comics and novels and movies combined noir all-star team.
Combined noir along with my partner.
Was there something about that time or place that got you into the adventure stuff, or was it of its time in a certain way? Because you said born in 29, you were the right age
for
it.
Well, I think it was of everybody's time. I mean, we were just coming out of the war, Second World War. We were the victor, and we were less damaged than anybody else. And for some reason, rather than euphoria, what was unleashed were these sci-fi movies about aliens coming from outer space and taking us over, or a series of men coming home from war and finding that women betrayed them, the femme fatales who they had come home to, were fatal to them over and over and over again. And there was this kind of dark side to this victory. And it was fascinating, you know, and all of us fell for it. I fell for the language. The language was so salty, and since I never wrote in that style before, it was such a joy to leap into it and to pretend I'm not me, but I'm one of them, and that's the joy of this kind of shift.
For this book, the word noir is French for black, so this is a dark genre. But what's the essence of it for you? Is it about the seedier side of life, but also with a campy sense of humor? Or how would you describe the soul of noir?
I think, well, first of all, the French got it from American films. They got it from the Bogart films, from the Houston films, from Howard Hawks. They picked all of that up and called it noir. And it began with Jean-Luc Godard doing Breathless with Belmondo. And what they picked up, I guess, was a dryness of style, a coolness. You know, it was early cool before cool was in. And detachment with a moral base to it. Well, I got rid of the moral base and kept the detachment.
In this book? Well, what kind of noir story did you set out to tell here?
Well, first of all, when I had the title came to me called Kill My Mother. I had nothing to go with the title, but I was going to find some way of illustrating it. And slowly,
and I saw right in the first few panels that comes up in the dialogue, you have two teenagers dancing, and the girl says, I want to kill my mother sometimes.
Because I'm a father of three daughters. And come from a family where there were two sisters, and I was the boy, and I know about mothers and daughters, and that seemed to be natural to take me right into this. And once I had that, and started with the generation of the time of 1933, with musicals like Gold Diggers of 1933, and where the entertainment forms acknowledged the Depression, but there was a spirit of optimism that. For that matter, we haven't had in this particular time with this particular recession or depression or whatever you want to call it. So the mood was fairly upbeat, no matter how poor people were, and that's what these kids are. And I wanted to create that period and draw that period. And I'd never drawn backgrounds in my voice cartoons. For those familiar with it, it was just figures minimally outlined against no background at all. But noir is full of atmosphere. It's full of rainy streets. It's full of cars. I never drew a car. Full of all sorts of reflected light, all this strange stuff that I never do. I had to learn how to do it. And thank God for Google for part of that. But the big thing was having a 65-inch television screen I went out and bought and got on to Turner Classic Movies and just recorded these 30s and 40s films. And then push the pause button and install my backgrounds.
You have a 65-inch television?
It was worth every. It's wonderful.
You're a modern guy now.
It's wonderful. Flat screen. It's as good as a movie. I don't have to go out of the house.
Jules Pfeiffer, our guest. His new graphic novel called Kill My Mother. Anybody want to call and talk to Jules Pfeiffer about any of his work? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Visually, as I've been looking through this, I noticed this is not a full-color comic or cartoon look. It's sort of black and white and sepia-toned, maybe is the right way to put it. Were you thinking sort of black and white movie in cartoon form?
Absolutely. I couldn't imagine doing this in color because the mood isn't in color. The feeling isn't in color. And the only noir film I can think of that worked in color was Chinatown. And also doing it in color was just too ambitious for a guy of my years. I mean, so I filled in with blues and gray and toned yellow grays and all, just trying to create the atmosphere. In the meantime, at the same time I was doing this book, I stopped a couple of for about a month or so to do a second book, which is out now too, a picture book for kids called Rupert Can Dance. So I and these two forms, picture books for kids and this noir thing, just filled my time deliriously because they're all forms that I enjoy working to the hilt.
And Rupert Can Dance, a lot of movement. I think you like to draw movement. Like this opens with two characters who I mentioned before having a dialogue while dancing with each other.
That's right.
To a Ginger Rogers song in 1933.
That's right. That's right. Dancing, for some reason or other, I picked up in the early months of my strip in The Voice. Well, I know the reason. I was going out with a dancer. And I love the commentary that dancers made when she took me to these recitals. Mm. And I love the movement because the strips were mostly conversation dialogues with people didn't move. This gave me a chance to do action figures, and they were all women in leotards. So I've never recovered from that and find ways of doing it wherever I can. I'd never been able to figure out how to do it in a kid's book until I thought of a dancing cat, and that's what I'm doing here. And in Kill My Mother, there are excuses for dancers all through the book.
Are there techniques as an artist for drawing motion on a still panel?
I've never learned any technique at all. It's all instinct and following the line as my finger takes me here and there and wherever.
I'm going to put you on the phone with a fan. Stuart in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Jules Pfeiffer. Hello, Stuart.
Hello. Hi, Jules. It's a thrill to talk to you. I just want to say that since I was probably in early high school, I was performing a lot of your vignettes from Hold Me, and I've had a high regard for everything that you've done.
Thank you.
And then you wrote Little Murders, and I said, not only is he brilliant, but he's also the prophet of our times, because the things that you explored in that piece there's so much truth in it that it's frightening. But
These were cautionary tales that I hope would stop us.
Stuart, thank you. So Little Murders, 1967, and then a few years later, that was on stage, and then a few years later in the movies, right?
Well, it was 67 on Broadway, where it ran all of a week and got trashed by the critics, who thought the themes of it were so ridiculous, nothing like this could ever possibly happen.
I want to play a clip and then finish telling the story. But so people who don't know this film can know little of what we're talking about. One character at the beginning of the movie has just been mugged and sort of mugged and mugged and mugged on the street. A woman intervenes to help save him, and then she's getting mugged by some of the same people, and he doesn't intervene to save her, so they have this exchange.
Listen, they were killing you! Why didn't you help me? You could have defended me, I defended you. Don't you think you should have at least tried? I mean, people help each other all the time. Isn't that what life is all about?
Look, I don't know why you want to make such a big thing out of it. Those guys in the park, they said, hey, fat face, what are you staring at? If I told them I wasn't staring at them, they would have beat me up for being a liar. And if I told them I was staring at them because I wanted to take their picture, then they'd beat me up for being a cop. So I told them I was staring at them because they looked familiar and they beat me up for being a fag. There's no way of talking someone out of beating you up if that's what he wants to do.
That from Little Murders around 1970. Jules, the caller said you were a prophet for Little Murders. But I wonder if that's, you know, a New York of days gone by now, and that's how you see it.
Well, it seemed to be representative of the Upper West Side in the 1960s when I was living there, which is very different from the Upper West Side today. But a lot of things that people said were prescient of me, it seemed to me so obvious that I couldn't understand what they were talking about. As a Cold War cartoonist in The Voice in those years, I was just documenting what I saw in front of me, which is people government saying one thing and meaning something else. I mean, when the credibility gap was invented by Lyndon Johnson, so-called, it seemed to me had to have been enforced for some years long before LBJ. And I was just putting down what I thought was in front of me.
So as a kid, you were into action stories, and then you worked with Will Eisner, one of the greats in that field. But for most of your career, you've been better known for social satire or political satire or commentary using comics. What were the things going on in the world as you were coming up as a young adult that politicized you and got you going in that direction?
Well, I think the first thing was the Hollywood blacklist, but that got my attention. And this was long before I ever thought of writing professionally or doing movie scripts. But it seemed to me that to shut people up from their work, particularly the screenwriters.
McCarthyism, some of them, 1950s.
Yes, and this is long before Joe McCarthy.
This
was before Joe McCarthy, and this repression was and loyalty oaths. It seemed to me that the country we were living in, liberals were not aware that they had First Amendment rights in those years during the tail end of the Eisenhower years. And when I began in The Voice, I was just saying the things that people weren't talking about, but thinking about, and perhaps talking to friends about. So I put that in the paper and put an entertaining spin on it because I thought if you want to get through to somebody, you better be funny.
We've had a few guests this summer recalling the early days of the Village Voice in the 1950s and early 60s. How did you first hook up with the Voice?
Well, I had been trying to sell my long narrative satires, one about a four-year-old kid who got drafted by mistake. I wrote that while I was in the Army in 1950, one and two.
Wow. Was that Monroe?
That's Monroe, yes. I've been trying for years to sell it to publishers, and nobody would go near it. And what I got finally from admiring editors who still wouldn't publish it is that nobody knew who I was. I didn't have a name. Essentially, they were saying, go out and become Saul Steinberg or William Steig, and then we'll publish you, or James Thurber. So I had to figure out a way of getting famous so I could get published. And on all their desks, I saw copies of this newspaper I didn't really know called The Voice. So I went down to The Voice's headquarters on Greenwich Avenue, and I showed them my samples. They loved it, and they said, do anything you want, and that was the beginning.
Jules Pfeiffer, my guest on WNYC, 212-433-WNYC, his new graphic novel, Kill My Mother. Harvey in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Harvey.
Good morning. Excuse me. At first, in deference to Bogey, we have to call it the Maltese Falcon. And and you could hardly have that noir genre today because young people cannot stand black and white. Now, there's a film out right now with Mickey Rourke, and I saw the original, and I didn't much care for it myself, to tell you the truth. But it's a different world nowadays. As we, those of us of a certain age know, some of the best films ever made were in black and white.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. But it's not just the quality of the work. It's a sense of reality that the work seems to indicate. I mean, there's something in that black and white world, an invented universe, that is so in and of itself that it becomes an alternate reality. And after you see enough of those films, you go out in the street and the world you look in color seems to take on a black and white tone. It begins to dominate the reality that you are envisioning at the time.
He said that it couldn't exist today because nobody would stand for a black and white film anymore. And I don't know that that's a deal breaker, black and white. Do you think there's any noir retro cool taking place right now?
I think there is, and a few films are made in black and white. A silent movie of a few years ago.
Right.
In addition, you see commercials in black and white, and nobody's more interested in the bottom line than people who make commercials. So if they find some value in it, they must be.
Gary in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Jules Pfeiffer. Hi, Gary.
Hi. It's an honor to speak to you, Jules.
Thank you.
I just wanted to share one little thing. My three daughters, who are now all grown in their mid-20s, when they were little in the 1990s, one of their favorite books of all time was The Phantom Toll Booth. And I remember bringing the book home and opening it up and saying, wait, what? This is illustrated by Jules Pfeiffer? Jules Pfeiffer, who did all these incredibly sarcastic political cartoons over the decades and Carnal Knowledge and everything else. And they loved those illustrations in the Phantom Toll Booth. We would read the book over and over and over again, and the illustrations are just brilliant. So I want to thank you for that.
Well thank you. You were no more surprised than I was that I did the book. But Norton Juster, who wrote it, was my roommate, and he was cooking, and I wouldn't eat unless I drew it for him.
He what? You were cooking?
And no. Norton was a chef. He was a cook.
Uh huh.
And I was the eater.
You had to pay him somehow.
I had to pay him somehow.
You're just hyper creative over your lifestyle. I mean, how many people work in as many media as you do? You made plays and movies in addition to the cartoons that you're probably best known for, and Phantom Tollbooth and Carnal Knowledge and your political Pfeiffer stuff coming out of the same brain. It's unbelievable.
Well, it's not to me because it's all spins on an attitude and a politics and a way of looking at the world that I've had since, I guess, my early 20s or late teens. And it's a way of figuring out ways of telling a story and the style in which that story must be told. And doing this noir book, doing Kill My Mother, required the approach I took, just as the picture books for kids, from Park George to Rupert Can Dance, required that. So essentially, it's different parts of my brain, but the same sensibility.
So reading up on you last night, because I wanted to fill in the holes of, you know, things
That's
I didn't
cheating.
Remember. I cheat every day. That's the thing about radio, it's an open book test. I saw several references to you angering people on the left when you criticized or satirized the student left at one point, I guess 60s or 70s, but I couldn't find what you actually did. Do you know what that refers to?
Yes, mocking some of the twisted innocence of these kids at the time, who started out for all of the right reasons and then moved gradually because of frustration, because they were ineffective, because nothing was happening, in some insane directions. And when that became clear, I began to comment on it. The vast point was that they were whatever they were doing that was wrong, they didn't have the power to do something that was monumentally wrong, which the United States government was doing every minute of the day.
Right. But people got angry. And maybe because you're not of that generation. You're not a boomer. You're their parents' generation. The greatest generation, as Tom Brokaw would have you, which I wonder, even though you were in The Voice, which, you know, was so integral to the counterculture of that time, if it made you see some of the 60s and 70s political movements differently from the young readers and writers.
I'm not sure. Well, I never figured out and never cared to figure out how other people were seeing it because I was too busy staggering around trying to figure it out for myself. Those were times if you were a more or less young adult at the time, and I was moving into middle age from young adulthood, where it seemed to me every week there was a surprise, there was a crisis, there was something staggering, whether it was the Chicago Convention in 68, and I was at that, or marches in the streets, or the bombing of Cambodia and the denial that we were doing any such thing, to discover. First of all, when I grew up as a New Deal child, I believed in our government, and I believed government could fix things. And then seeing the government turn around and do some dreadful stuff and deny it and deny it and deny it, as the government is doing to this very day, was shocking and perplexing. And if you grew up as a young idealist, demoralizing in terms of your belief in country.
Any last thing you want to say about the new book, your first graphic novel, Kill My Mother?
Yes, it's got a sequel coming up and a third book after that I finally found the form that in my 80s I want to keep working on, which is great because having aged into deafness and lack of movement, I can't move around the way I used to. I can stay home and just draw, and write. It's a ball. I'm having some of the best times I've ever had in my life.
And the book is a ball. You can still draw, and write. What an honor to have you. Jules Pfeiffer, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.